Hello, Gallatin Valley. Welcome to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. Our producer is Robin Fly. Our guest today is Dr. Leo Kilsback. Dr. Kilsback is an associate professor in the Department of Native American Studies at Montana State University. He grew up on the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation in Busby and is devoted to the preservation and resurgence of Cheyenne language and culture. Much of our conversation today will draw on his award-winning two-volume set of books, A Sacred People, Indigenous Governance, Traditional Leadership, and the Warriors of the Cheyenne Nation, and A Sovereign People, Indigenous Nationhood, Traditional Law, and the Covenants of the Cheyenne Nation. Dr. Kilsback, congratulations on winning the Stubendieck Great Plains Distinguished Book Prize.
Thank you.
So today we're going to explore the history and present and future of the Cheyenne Nation in our conversation with you. But Dr. Kilsback, could you please start by telling listeners a little about your upbringing and your time with your grandmother, Jessie Limpy Longjaw?
Yes. Well, I grew up on a Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation and was raised by my mother. She was a single parent to six of us. And being the youngest, I was frequently taken to my grandmother's house, and she was deaf and mute. And can I just close this window? I hear people talking.
Sure.
I gotta close this window. Sorry about that. So, yeah, you know, I was one of many grandchildren, and usually the youngest child of a family or of a parent is, given to an elder grandparent. So I had, I think, two other cousins who were also, given to my grandmother. And nowadays you say babysitting, but for us it was also more of a cultural tradition, so that the younger folks can, you know, learn from their grandparents. And we still practice this today, in fact. In some cases it's to help preserve our language, but help preserve our culture, and also relieves the parents of parental duties from time to time. But I cherish those times with my grandmother. I was very young, and of course she was deaf and mute, but we communicated through sign language, and myself still learning language at the time, it became a very, I guess, positive thing. And I still have my cousins, they still are able to communicate using sign language because of that, and members of my family also still can communicate using sign language because that's part of our family. Other families may have folks who speak the language, so that's kind of where we see this, acts of cultural resilience and survival, despite the impacts of assimilation and even ongoing, assimilation, the unseen powers of assimilation. And in our communities, we tend not to think of those types of cultural practices to be unordinary. In fact, even when I was a child, it was pretty common to see that as a means to survive. So it's only when we leave our community do we see that that's unordinary. Mainstream white Americans don't necessarily have those types of cultural practices to preserve their culture and language, because obviously there was never a threat of them it being taken from them. And So there's a lot of things that I guess not just me, but people in my generation had faced growing up, because we're at the juncture of, I guess, major change, major technological change. And, you know, we had video games being introduced to us. A lot of us didn't have cable television. So cable television really wasn't a factor growing up in Busby. But then as soon as, you know, the satellite systems came to play, of course, that's going to have an influence. And so you have technology having an impact on culture.
So instead of traditional stories, for example, you might be listening to whatever was being broadcast instead?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. At the same time, you know, our parents, a lot of our parents were survivors of the assimilation, the last of the assimilation policies. Our parents are boarding school survivors. There was a boarding school in Busby, Montana called Tongue River Boarding School. It was a BIA-run boarding school. And so that had a major impact throughout the generations, through, you know, as long as it has been around. It was around for quite a long time since the reservation was established. But the cultural impact, the impact that it had on our culture was really, it really had us, I think, a significant impact on the later generations. Parents no longer, I guess, spoke the language to their children. And, you know, even before that, the loss of our oral tradition, meaning storytelling and the teachings involved in storytelling, had, for the most part, gone underground. And so if you were exposed to those, it was kind of a blessing to hear those. I know at our school, at Northern Cheyenne Tribal School, we had a language program and a culture program early on. And it was pretty, it was very sophisticated, because we did learn from, you know, people who were fluent in the language, people who we recognized as elders and sacred people, is what I talk about. You know, the majority of them were elderly women and that came to our schools and taught us things, taught us about our culture, told us stories, taught us language. So I thought that was very powerful for our generation. And as and then in the community, just growing up in the community, we sort of knew who the I guess the folks were who held on to the actual traditions and ceremonial practices. So being a young man and coming of age, a lot of us young men, we started engaging in minor ceremonies and stuff. And for the most part, it was sort of seen as, I guess, if you grew up in the community and if you grew up within the family structures and social structures that existed, it was sort of normal that, oh, you just kind of, oh, we're having a sweat lodge, you know, come on over kind of thing. And that's still being practiced to this day, but I think it's a little more deliberate now, because I think folks who didn't grow up with that, you know, they want that, and it's their culture, and so they have rights to that. And but they just don't know how to navigate it, because maybe their parents were not didn't value that, or their grandparents didn't value that. Maybe they valued a different religious belief or spiritual belief, being Christianity in whatever form or shape. And, you know, don't get me wrong, we went to, you know, churches as well, you know, and we went to we engaged in church activity as well, being in a small community. But there was always a presence of, you know, there always is a presence of the ongoing ceremonial and traditional practices that are occurring. And so nowadays, you know, because of social media and all that stuff, you know, I guess the major threat is protecting those from outsiders, from exploiting them. But that's just sort of how the upbringing is. You kind of aware that, you know, you don't want people to be posting stuff on social media to I guess be culture vultures or pirates of
right.
our of
culture
our,
vultures.
Of our ways.
I hadn't heard that term, but it's a perfect term, unfortunately. But your mother, for example, then. was someone who valued tradition and culture and spirituality to a certain extent, I think, because you talk about the time she took you to see the Sacred Hat Keeper and what that meant to you. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I introduced that in my second book to talk about how, you know, how, I mean, and then again, back in the day, it was sort of a common thing. I mean, growing up, it was sort of a common thing to, and my mom being a single parent and us boys maturing into manhood, of course, she's going to rely on our uncles and other relatives and friends to help assist in us becoming, you know, men. Yeah, I mean, that was just one of the more significant events that have of many that I think if you grow up on a reservation that I for one am able to reflect upon as to the significance of our culture and the significance of our traditional systems of balance and conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. Growing up, being the youngest of four boys, and going through the growing pains, I guess, just being an adolescent, you know, that poses so many challenges. And I think a lot of young folks, because of the society that has been forced upon them, they don't really realize that we have an entire legacy of how to navigate through those challenging times. And that was one of the more memorable experiences that I had, which I chose to put in there because it wasn't just a personal experience. It involved, it placed emphasis on family, and placed emphasis on brotherhood, and lessons that we learn, or I guess teachings that we learned, we hope to carry those through into adulthood and hope to pass that on to our children. Should we ever come to a situation or a time when we need assistance or help, there's folks who are going to be there for us. And that was something that, you know, that was, like I said, that was one of many instances where we kind of, I thought was important to note that, they're ongoing practices, and that they can have a positive impact, and they do have a positive impact, you know, upon for the betterment of long term, you know, for the greater good of the family and even the community. So
this is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. Our guest today is Dr. Leo Kilsbach. Dr. Kilsbach, speaking of role models and family, in the beginning of your first book, you tell the story of Stinkbat and the impact that had on you. Could you relay that story?
Well, yes. Going back to just personal development of, you know, becoming a man, adulthood, learning what it means to be a productive member of the community from the Cheyenne perspective. And I'm sure, without a doubt, other Plains Indian tribes and other Indian nations across America have similar stories and memories and teachings. But the story of Stinkbat and his heroics were something that I think really stood out. And as I got older, I reflect upon it. And Stinkbat was an orphan, and so he wasn't. You know, a lot of the stories in Indian traditions and cultures do not match up or don't fall in line with a lot of European-based stories that, you know, which are pretty, by this point in time, they're kind of predictable, you know, they're kind of mm-hmm. predictable about a hero's origin story or a hero's, legacy. And without giving too much away, you know, the story of Stinkbat is one of heroics, but it's also one that tells of sacrifice and something that I think was embedded in the Cheyenne culture and belief system of what it meant to be part of a community. And I think if that story and stories like that, which I present in my book, which are, you know, stories of our people that have been recorded. I think our young people, especially our young men, would have a different perspective and outlook on life about, especially as they become men, especially as they learn these ways of how to, you know, treat each other and treat one another. And don't get me wrong, I mean, there's a lot of stories that and a lot of teachings that are also that also teach about womanhood and or the roles of woman. And I do my best, you know, being a man to being a male author to try to explain some of these concepts from I guess the Cheyenne perspective. But the story of Stink Bat, I think, is one that I return to at the conclusion of the book to reemphasize mm-hmm. that, you know, these stories have meaning and they actually are not just fairy tales and they're not just something that is you know, good to know. I know a lot of times when people think of Native American studies, they think the information or the content of say a book or a course is just stuff that's good to know without realizing that, you know, folks like myself had entered into this field and discipline and this profession as academics to promote change and positive change, especially in Indian country, where, you know, we're typically marginalized or ignored. And of course, our young men are one of the populations that are ignored mm-hmm. and marginalized. Our young women, of course, as well, you know, but basically, our young people, you know, in general, are typically ignored and, in some cases, viewed as hostile to mm-hmm. to the mainstream, which is not the case. Which is why I like, you know, the show Reservation Dogs. Just to throw that in there, but yeah. So I hope that helps answer your question about.
It does. Thank you. And one of the things that I learned from your books is that some of the stories are warnings to learn. They contain lessons. And you talk about, your writing now is very focused on, I would say, you know, having harmony and peacekeeping and peacemaking as a goal. But it sounds as if in Cheyenne history, the nation kind of moved from being less harmonious to more harmonious. And there are stories that people can draw lessons from about leaders who had their, you know, not the good of the whole nation. Could you talk about that evolution a little bit?
Yes, well, it's actually something that I, that entire ideology of the, I guess, the growth of a society, excuse me, that growth and decay of a society and rebirth of a society is something that I study as a historian. And some things, you know, I wrote an article about it, about how it's important to know why and where, I guess, new philosophies come from and why they're in place. And in this case, I guess we're talking about in particular leadership. Poor leadership and good leadership, you know, why do we have a system in place that in Cheyenne traditional leadership systems, why is that system in place? And there's a number of stories that recall why some leaders will fail, why some leaders were terrible, why some systems just didn't fit with the needs of the people. And this theory that I pose is that all societies will typically have in their history a time when they didn't get it right. You know, they didn't get it right. They tried something out. They didn't get it right. So they had to redo it. They had to reevaluate how they're going to approach something, a governance system, a leadership system. And in order for that to be effective, for the long term, throughout the generations, people would have to remember why and how those new philosophies and new theories developed. Take for example, today we you know, we see a lot of studies on leadership and governance and poor leadership and bad politicians making terrible decisions, right? Is this the first time that this has happened in human history? And I contend that no, it's not. It's something that if you look throughout history, it's actually common in history, which eventually leads to change and reform. And for Native people, you know, we have these stories, but we don't know if they're 1,000 years old or 10,000 years old. So we don't know if that event had occurred, of the poor leader making these terrible decisions, occurred just recently, or if we remembered it for this long and we remember and we are reminded each time we tell that story to not fall into those you know, those pitfalls that these leaders had fallen into, which is very different than, say, political science, the study of political science, or even the study of history in general. Folks tend to believe that we're at the pinnacle of humanity in, I guess, mainstream study, and that this is the first time that we've ever seen a tyrant, or first time we've ever seen a political structure crumble, or a threat to a political entity, or just a political ideology. When it may be the first time, say, for like the young United States, which has only been around for about 200 or so years. But some of these Native nations have been around for thousands of years, and so they had experienced a lot of, you know, good and bad, and remembering both the good and the bad, the turmoil and the success, and will strengthen, reinforce why things are done the way they are done. And that's why, in my discussion of Indigenous governance and traditional leadership, it's those stories exist. You know, we have tyrants in our culture, in our history, in our memory. Did they exist after the establishment of the new, you know, chief system, or the new traditional, I guess, the new fundamental laws, you know, brought by different prophets and political thinkers? I'd say very likely no, you know, highly unlikely not that those personalities could rise to that, to a position of leadership, because people remember, well, that's just a personality. That's just a personality trait that relates to this person that in history that really didn't do so well. And maybe that person who has that personality, maybe we shouldn't allow that person to thrive, or maybe that person with that personality, needs to work on their people skills a bit more before we give them any more responsibilities. You know, the threats could be detrimental to the people. So,
well, I hope we'll actually be talking a great deal more about your suggestions about how the Cheyenne Nation, people in the nation, might move forward if this is one of those times of change that you're talking about. But before we get to that, could you just explain, I know that you talk about nations, not tribes in general. Could you talk about the significance of that terminology?
Yes, great question. I think the term tribes has always been troublesome, even though it's been used in federal Indian law since the establishment of the United States government. In the Constitution, they do mention Indian tribes. From a Native perspective, from a sovereign perspective, even just in general, the mainstream perspective of tribes is very archaic. Excuse me. Very, it carries a lot of assumptions of primitive peoples, and that's something. I mean, we say, Northern Cheyenne tribe, you know, but and other tribes as well use that terminology because that's what's in the books. But if we need to move away from that, I think, because tribes weren't necessarily, you know, there's a textbook definition of what a tribe is, and a lot of times that's even, that's what Indian nations are associated with. But you have nations, For example, the Northern Cheyenne Nation is comprised of, traditionally comprised of 10 bands. And those bands, you know, their populations could be as large as 400, 500, somewhere as big as 1,000 at one point. But to me, those are more like the band system, those are more like tribes in a sense. But the nation itself is the entire group of those people, and they're unified under a much larger, I guess, political system. And their land, I guess their presence on the land also was much larger. So it wasn't like, when you think of a tribe, you think of a tribe that is almost landless, almost, you know, especially on the plains, there's connotations of, they're always moving around and following the herds and all that. But when you think of a nation, it changes the conversation, mm-hmm. because you're talking about a much larger territory and much more people and a much more sophisticated political system. So that's just one example. But also in just the relationship between tribes and the federal government and even states is one between sovereign entities. So there's the federal government that's a sovereign entity. There's the states that are a sovereign entity, and there's tribes that are sovereign entities. And, you know, I try my best to try to emphasize that tribes are nations, because once tribes, Indian people start identifying and start seeing themselves as nations rather than tribes, then they can sort of decolonize their minds and move away from the assimilation, I guess, assimilated based teachings that they are less mm-hmm. than. And right now, when you say tribes, it's like, oh, we're less than, we're less than what? We're less than the other sovereign. But when you say nations, oh, we were a nation, so we have sovereignty. We retain a degree of inherent sovereignty, and we have rights as a nation. So being a member or being part of a nation is much, much different. And it does, in the past, even when the United States government was signing treaties with Indian tribes, they would refer to them as nations, and their land would be reserved under, you know, for that nation. And you know, and when you move to the I guess the West Coast, you have more confederated tribes, meaning numerous tribes that are part of a confederacy. Same thing with historically back east, there was the multiple confederacies. So those are confederacies, but that's still a confederacy is much more, I guess, carries much more political clout and much more political stronger presence than, say, tribes. You know, so that's kind of what I get at, and what I can do with the work that I do, knowing full well that, you know, it's probably going to take a lot more, and we're probably not going to move away from the term tribes for a long time, especially in federal Indian law. So I hope that helps.
Well, Dr. Kilsbeck, we have about 1 minute left on this first half hour, and of course we're going to come back and continue the conversation. But we're talking a lot about your two award-winning books, A Sacred People and A Sovereign People. I heard that you worked with more than 80 elders on this, spent many years doing exhaustive research. Can you tell us, where can people get the books? I imagine Amazon. Are there places in town they can get them?
I don't know if they have them in town, but yeah, Amazon is a good source, I guess. There's also Barnes & Noble online.
Okay.
And when I say I worked with 80 folks, there's probably more that, you know, I really didn't cite them directly, because in our culture, it's sort of like, you know, they kind of know me and my work and my presence. So.
All right. Well, thank you, listeners. Please join us in the next half hour as we continue our conversation with Dr. Kilsbeck about his books. You're listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman.